It was, of course, not the production of intellectuals that motivated the Judaic love of learning, but rather the idea that a society structured around divine law should be one in which everyone had equal access to knowledge and therefore equal dignity as citizens in the Republic of Faith. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 57, The Remarkable Sages of the Sanhedrin. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It is a striking statement in the Talmud, one which describes how Torah teachers and sages descended from enemies of the Jewish people. Quote, "The descendants of Haman learnt the Torah in Bnei Brak. Descendants of Sisera taught children in Jerusalem. Descendants of Sancheriv gave public expositions of the Torah. Who were these? Shemaiah and Avtalion." End quote. Haman, of course, is the great enemy of the Jews in the Esther story. Sisera was the general against whom Deborah waged war, and Sancheriv was the emperor of Assyria, whose army God had destroyed at the gates of Jerusalem. Shemaiah and Avtalion, described by the descendants of this great enemy of Israel, may have been the most interesting example of this phenomenon that the Talmud describes. For these great sages and teachers of Torah provide us with an embodiment of the remarkable intellectual approach of Second Temple Pharisaic Judaism, and why it set the stage for its own endurance. Over the past several weeks, we have been charting the political leadership of Jerusalem, while noting that religiously, two sects were rivals in the city. The Pharisees, representatives of what later became known as Rabbinic Judaism, to whom the masses in the city remained loyal, and the Sadducees, who denied the teachings of the oral law and who were made up to a great extent of the elite and the priesthood. We further saw how the Hasmoneans, once themselves Pharisees, switched sides, and how Queen Shlomtzion placed her power behind the Pharisees again. Now, as we discuss the end of the Hasmonean dynasty, which can be traced to the arrival of Rome and Pompeii in Jerusalem in 64 BCE, we must step back and discuss the development of Pharisaic leadership from the arrival of the Greeks in Jerusalem, a leadership that will so profoundly influence the Jewish and Judaic reaction to the destruction of the temple. The key to understanding the course this leadership took can be found in the Mishnaic text Avot, which means fathers, colloquially called Pirkei Avot, chapters of the fathers, and in English, commonly though very inaccurately, known as Ethics of the Fathers. The tractate is known for presenting a series of theological, legal, and moral maxims from the rabbis, and it has rightly become beloved among many. As the Mosaic columnist known as Philologos put it, quote, "I have found Pirkei Avot ideal for reading in the synagogue itself, preferably during the sermon, for sheer beauty of thought and expression. No modern rabbi comes near it," end quote. Now, that, ladies and gentlemen, may cut a little close to home, but Avot is an incredibly important text, indeed more important than is often appreciated. As I argued in my Tikva lectures on Avot, the maxims contained within it, especially in its early chapters, should be seen as reflections of the unique challenges faced by the leaders of Pharisaic Rabbinic Judaism in each generation during the Second Temple period and the years that followed. Let us see how this is so. Avot begins with the last of the mysterious group of men known as the Great Assembly, Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Righteous, who according to the Talmud was the leader of Jerusalem when Alexander the Great arrived. We are then told in Avot of the name of his student and spiritual successor, Antigonus, man of Socho, and we are meant, as we have already mentioned, to immediately intuit from his very non-Jewish name how profoundly Hellenist culture had infiltrated and impacted Judea. But, this non-Jewish name notwithstanding, Antigonus, in the face of Hellenism, emphasized a profoundly Jewish message, as cited in Avot. "Obey God," he said, "V'yeh mora shamayim aleichem, let the fear of heaven be upon you." We have further mentioned how one of the great challenges facing the Jews of the Second Temple era was the end of Revelation, the disappearance of prophets from among Israel. Religious decisions from this point onward would be declared by spiritual leaders drawing on their own reasoning. This would mean, of course, that the potential for disagreement would also exist. And it is with this in mind that we can appreciate that following Antigonus Ish Socho, in generation after generation, spiritual leadership was held by not one, but two figures. This, I think, should be understood as a reaction to the recognition of human difference. Perhaps it was assumed that the future of Judaism was best served with duality. And a period of Jewish history begins known as the age of the Zugot, the pairs. Rather than one leader, there is two, the senior being the head of the Sanhedrin, and the second known as Av Beit Din, father of the court. Thus, as Avot describes, Antigonus Manefsocha was succeeded by two men, both named Yossi, Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan. After them, the next generation was served and led by another two, Yehoshua ben Prachya and Nitai of Arbel, and then another two, Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach. Two sages led in every generation, not because they were the same, but because they were not, because they did disagree. It is recognition of human difference that led to the period of the peers, and it is no coincidence that the first rabbi to take part in a pair, Yehoshua ben Prachya, bequeaths us in Avot with a maxim that celebrates the joining of law with comradeship. Asei lecha rav, he said, make for yourself a teacher, uknei lecha chaver, but also acquire a colleague. The concept of collegiality in leadership was emphasized because human difference itself, within the context of fealty to Jewish tradition, was celebrated in this period, was welcomed in this period. And in the face of disagreement, ultimately the rabbis will give a famous description of debate. These and these are the words of the living God. Of the pairs, it was Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai who led during the age of the Sadducee king Alexander Yanaeus and his successor, Queen Shlomtzion. It was Shimon, as we have discussed, who worked side by side with the queen to restore the influence of the Pharisees and to institute the strengthening of families and education. And the focus on universal education reveals an enormous openness to all members of society engaging the Torah, and if they reveal themselves, to have potential for leadership, to becoming leaders and teachers of Torah. This, in turn, brings us to the next pair of Pharisaic leaders that were not perhaps the most famous, but were still, in a certain sense, the most interesting. And this would be a pair who would have overseen the Pharisaic community at the moment we have reached in our story, the moment the Hasmonean dynasty lost independent control of Jerusalem and Rome extended its power over the city. This pair was known as Shemaiah and Avtalion, and they, as the Talmud tells us, were either converts or descendants of converts, descendants, it would seem, of Assyrians. And the Talmud seems to signify that the heritage of Shemaiah and Avtalion was mocked by the elitist priests that would have stood at the center of Sadducee influence. Thus, we are told in Tractate Yoma of one Kohen Gadol, one high priest, who mocked these revered sages. Quote, our rabbis taught, it happened with a high priest that as he came forth from the sanctuary, all the people followed him. But when they saw Shemaiah and Avtalion, they forsook him and went after Shemaiah and Avtalion. Eventually, Shemaiah and Avtalion visited him to take their leave of the high priest. He said to them, may the descendants of the heathen come in peace. They answered him, may the descendants of the heathen who do the work of Aaron arrive in peace. But the descendants of Aaron who does not do the work of Aaron, he shall not come in peace. End quote. In other words, Shemaiah and Avtalion responded that they, and not the high priest, truly lived in the spirit of Scripture, truly embodied the spirit of Aaron, the original high priest. As Yonatan Feintuch writes, quote, the message in this regard is that greatness is not necessarily dependent on venerable lineage. Rather, a person has to mold himself and his behavior. End quote. Of course, in certain areas of Jewish law, lineage does make a difference. The monarchy is designated for the house of David. Only descendants of Aaron, the high priest, can be priests themselves, and only they can enter the most sacred spheres of the temple. Yet the study of Torah is open to all. And this means that even as the Sadducee elite celebrated the priesthood in particular, the Pharisaic leadership, the rabbinic leadership, remained profoundly welcoming and open in the intellectual sphere. Thus it will be that some of the most important rabbis that we will meet in the episodes to come were described by the Talmud and rabbinic literature as descendants of converts, including two of the most brilliant, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Meir. Perhaps the most succinct and eloquent embodiment of the Pharisaic perspective is the Talmudic description of Uncalus, a distinguished member of a Roman family who converted to Judaism and whose transmissions and teachings about the Torah impact us to this day. In the story about Uncalus told by the Talmud, Uncalus' conversion is described as having shocked and angered the Roman elite. But, we are further informed, Uncalus drew other converts to him by highlighting how for Judaism, God showed his love for humanity and was utterly unlike the divinities portrayed by the pagans. I cite the tale in the Talmud, which comes at the beginning of the episode from the Cencino translation. Quote, when Uncalus, the son of Colonimus, became a proselyte, the emperor sent a contingent of Roman soldiers after him, but he enticed them by citing scriptural verses and they became converted to Judaism. Thereupon the emperor sent another Roman cohort after him, bidding them not to say anything to him. As they were about to take him away with them, he said to them, let me tell you just an ordinary thing. In a procession, a torchlighter carries the light in front of the torchbearer, the torchbearer in front of the leader in front of the governor in front of the chief officer. But does the chief officer carry the light in front of the people that follow? No, they replied. Said he, yet the Holy One, blessed be he, does carry the light before Israel. For scripture says, and the Lord went before them in a pillar of fire to give them light. Then they too became converted. Again he sent another cohort, ordering them not to enter into any conversation whatever with him. So they took hold of him. And as they were walking on, he saw the mezuzah, which was fixed on the doorframe, and he placed his hand on it, saying to them, now what is this? And they replied, you tell us then. Said he, according to universal custom, the mortal king dwells within, and his servants keep guard on him without. But in the case of the Holy One, blessed be he, it is his servants who dwell within, whilst he keeps guard on them from without. As it is said, the Lord shall guard thy going out and thy coming in from this time forth and forevermore. Then they too were converted to Judaism. End quote. The message of the tale seems to be that unlike a pagan faith, where the gods were seen as beings that needed to be bribed and propitiated, and the emperors were seen as individuals that needed to be divinized, in Judaism, it is God alone who rules and it is God who seeks the good of human beings. It is God whose law is made open for the study of all. Thus, in a strange and striking way, even as politically the story we begin describes a very difficult period, the moment in which Jerusalem lost its independence, at the same time, what begins at this moment is also the flourishing intellectually of Torah study. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks once wrote as follows, quote, with a touch of exaggeration, the historian Paul Johnson calls Judaism an ancient and highly efficient social machine for the production of intellectuals. It was, of course, not the production of intellectuals that motivated the Judaic love of learning, but rather the idea that a society structured around divine law should be one in which everyone had equal access to knowledge and therefore equal dignity as citizens in the Republic of Faith. End quote. The Pharisees made Torah study open to all, and it was this that would so sustain the learning of Torah in the years to come. This is Meir Soloveitchik. Looking forward to learning together with you next week. Wishing you a Shabbat Shalom. Signing off.